There's a lot to talk about in the NBA today, guys. We went deep into the NBA draft on Monday's show with Chad Ford. Today, I'm bringing on Dr. Brian Suterer to dive even deeper into Darren Peterson, the creatine use. Did that cause the cramps? Or is there more to the story? Dr. Brian and I went really deep into that at the end of the show. And first, get Andrew Sharp, regular of the show, talking about everything going on in the NBA right now in the playoffs. The Lakers got eliminated. The Thunder are moving on. We get some 2-2 series with the Wolves and the Spurs, the Pistons and the Cavs. What's next for the Sixers? Who do the Knicks want next round? And Andrew's a Wizards fan as well, so we also got into what are the Wizards going to do at number one? What should they do? That's all coming up right now. All right, to talk about the NBA playoffs and the Wizards landing the number one pick from the GOAT, it's Andrew Sharp. Andrew, how are you?
Here we are. Always great to see you. I'm going to be in a great mood for the next 7 weeks after the Wizards won the lottery, and we're right in the thick of it with the playoff run here. So really no bad days for me out here in D.C.
I bet right now, especially with Wizards. Number one in the driver's seat. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Let's start off with the Western Conference. Thunder sweep the Lakers. They're 8-0 heading into the Western Conference Finals and doing it without Jalen Williams. On one hand, they got through an 8-seed, a play-in team, the Suns. They got through a Lakers team without Luka. Not totally surprising, but I do think still, Andrew, you can look at this Thunder team and just be so impressed by the fact that Jared McCain comes off the bench in game four, plus 27 in under 20 minutes. AJ Mitchell, game one, 18 points. Game two, 20 points. Game three, 24 points. Game four, 28 points. Averaging
greatest contract in the entire world.
$3 million. He has 24 assists to 4 turnovers in the series, 22.5 points per game. Just roasting Austin Reeves from game one through four. The Thunder are undeniably impressive. I don't care how weak the schedule was so far.
Breaking news live on the KOC show here. The Thunder will be picking up the team option on AJ Mitchell, $2.5 million in 2028. As he looks like, I mean, was he the third best player in this series? I thought LeBron played really well. And Shea obviously looked like an MVP for most of this series. Although it wasn't even a great Shea series. Like, he was fantastic closing in game four. But I would say probably a B or B minus from Shea, and they still looked head and shoulders above the Lakers in most of these games. And even when the Lakers were up midway through the fourth last night, I never thought that the Thunder weren't going to win. I'm glad the Thunder actually got it done at the end, because thinking about this series was kind of a chore over the last week or so. But yeah, the Thunder deserve a ton of credit. I would also give the Lakers some credit for showing up and not quitting in any of these games, including in game four on Monday night. Like, it would have been very easy for them to just sort of lay down, but they didn't do that. And I think to some degree, that's a credit to LeBron and his professionalism and the way he carries himself, because The deck was very clearly stacked against them in this matchup, but they showed up and gave it the old college try, and now we'll see whether somebody can push the Thunder finally in the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, I think you're right. With the Lakers, credit to J.J. Redick as well. He's definitely motivated his team. I think he's a good X's and O's coach. I think he pulled a lot of the right strings throughout the postseason as well, despite Austin Reeves missing time, despite Luka missing the entire postseason. That said, though, I mean, in all those highlights we just saw, if you're watching the podcast on YouTube, AJ Mitchell is roasting Austin Reeves. He was 11 for 19 in the series against Reeves, and Reeves was 22 turnovers in four games. He shot 30% from three, only 50% from two, not impactful defensively. Did Austin Reeves cost himself a max deal?
I mean, if Austin Reeves was going to get a max deal, that was a bad idea even before he came back in the playoffs. So maybe the Lakers were crazy enough to go that direction prior to this series. I would look at last year's series against the Wolves and say, well, there were some red flags with how Austin would fit in a playoff setting, regardless of what we saw over the last week or so. So to me, this just sort of confirms, like, he's a good player, very, very helpful during the regular season, but also in the playoffs, like, he's somebody who's going to get exploited defensively. And when you're playing him next to Luka Doncic, how high is the ceiling if that's the mix that you're bringing to the table? That would be my concern. The issue for the Lakers, though, is if you're not spending the money to bring Austin Reeves back into the fold, like, who else are you going to be spending on this summer, and what's plan B? And I don't think that they have a credible answer to that question. So they probably have to bring him back, but they're probably going to have to negotiate on price and try to get him for closer to $30, $35 million than anything like a max. And we'll see whether they have the leverage to do that. I mean, other teams, I'm sure, will be willing to talk themselves into Austin Reeves. What do you think the number will be?
I think around 30, like you said, feels appropriate to me. At the same time, I mean, like, I reported earlier in the year that the Utah Jazz had a lot of interest in Austin Reeves. This morning, The Athletic said the Jazz as well, and they also added the Atlanta Hawks as a team that have a lot of interest in Austin Reeves. And both those teams, you look at their rosters, Austin Reeves makes a hell of a lot of sense. And a lot more size and versatility around him on the defensive end of the floor as well. I like it. The fit feels better for Reeves, but is the basketball situation better? The life situation better for him? Is he happy in Los Angeles? Mm-hmm. Does he love playing that much with Luka? Did you see the report this morning about Luka? Luka doesn't want the Lakers to trade Austin Reeves for Giannis Antetokounmpo. That's how much he loves his brother Austin Reeves.
I'm of two minds on that report, because on one hand, I do love the Luka Austin Reeves bromance that has been brewing over the last 7 months or so. And it would be heartbreaking to see them torn apart. On the other hand, my initial reaction when I saw that report come across Twitter on Tuesday morning was, this is why front offices should just never listen to players when they offer their input on trades or free agents or whatever. Like, sure, Austin Reeves is a cool guy, but like, the Lakers ceiling is so much higher if they bring in Giannis. And so if you can fleece the Bucks somehow and convince them to reset around Austin Reeves, do it 1,000 times out of 1,000 and then figure out how to mend the relationship with Luka afterwards. And they're going to be paying Luka hundreds of millions of dollars, so I'm sure he'll get over it, but we'll see. I don't think the thing is, like, does Austin Reeves have real trade value if they were trying to flip him for somebody else? I don't know that the answer is yes, based on what we've seen over the last few years. I think he's a nice player, like borderline all-star maybe, but anything beyond that, I think teams are not going to be suspending disbelief about what his ceiling actually is.
I mean, what the quote that's been just rattling around my mind a lot this past week or so is what Brad Stevens said at his exit interview with the Celtics. And he's like, well, this year, a third of the teams weren't making an effort to win. This year wasn't the best evaluation of teams. He talked about how the Celtics were only 3-11 or whatever against top four seeds. But that's also true with players as well. And I think the playoffs is just such a different level of just scouting the way teams exploit weaknesses. We'll talk later about Jalen Dern and what's happened over there as well. But across the league, you see that. And with OKC, they are truly the best litmus test, considering what they're capable of doing on both ends of the floor. They are the best defense. And obviously, you can't necessarily hold that against Austin Reeves, that he wasn't able to have a great series after a month-long absence against Oklahoma City, but it is the best litmus test. And I think about that on both ends of the floor with them. With OKC, their bigs, their guards, their wings, there's no weak links on defense. And then offensively, they're so hard to stop, not just because of SGA, not just because A.J. Mitchell looks like he's making, you know, a tenth of the salary he should, but the bigs, too. The end of that game four, the interior scoring that they finished with Chet Holmgren inside, it was interior, but then
those,
like,
little passes from Hartenstein, man, tough. It's such an unfair cheat code for them that they can go to him in the high post, and he's great in that role. Yeah, I mean, top to bottom,
they can do outside,
there's no weakness.
Too, Andrew. It's everything. Yeah. It's inside. Chet can close out against you. Hartenstein can run DHOs. Chet can shoot threes, bring the ball up himself. It's they check literally every box, those two bigs.
They do. And I mean, you look at the Lakers, for instance, like, what do they do to get even half of those guys into LA? Like, because it's been carefully built in OKC. And so with Reeves as an example, I don't want to overreact too much to some of the offensive struggles that we saw from him early in the series, because OKC is effectively an impossible standard. Like, Anthony Edwards looks fantastic playing on 1.5 legs against the Spurs in the second round this year. A year ago in the Western Conference Finals, Anthony Edwards was a shell of himself going against this Thunder defense. And if AJ Mitchell was trying to do what he did over the last couple games against the OKC defense, he would probably look like a shell of himself. So basically, every guard is going to look maybe half as effective against a perimeter defense that's as dominant as OKC, and you pair the bigs at the rim. Like, it's a tough ask of anybody, but Reeves defensively is going to be a problem. And then you look at the front court, like, you know, DeAndre Ayton was benched in this series, and Jackson Hayes came up big in game four to make it a little interesting for everybody. But I don't think you want to rely on Jackson Hayes either. Jackson Hayes was benched a year ago. So how do you find somebody that you actually feel good about putting around Luka Doncic? And I think it's a tougher nut to crack. I will say that, like, we're now a year and a half on from the Luka trade, and we haven't seen much progress from the Lakers front office in terms of acquiring pieces that you feel good about for the next 4 or 5 years as you try to actually win a title with Luka Doncic. And like, last summer, it was, let's wait until next summer, let's bide our time, keep our powder dry, and we're going to have more space, and maybe LeBron won't be here. But the answers, when I look out there, are not that obvious. Like, do you overpay to bring in Tari Eason and trust him to be a better shooter and a two-way guy? Maybe, but like, you're going to be betting on guys who are not particularly reliable in this year's free agent class.
Yeah, and that's the tough part for them, because there's pretty clear the series, Ayton's not the guy. You just can't trust him. Clearly, JJ Redick, he himself said, I just can't play this guy.
Right. So, and I Ayton mean, was like, all things considered, I would say Ayton's season in LA was modestly successful. Like, it wasn't a disaster.
For the money, for that money, right? That he got. Yeah.
Right.
$8 million, whatever it was.
And yet he's still clearly not a championship level center at this point in his career. I don't know what happened from 2021 with the Suns to where we are today, but he's just not somebody. I mean, you can kind of count on him to mentally check out at some point, and you can't rely on that guy to contend. So how do you, I mean, the Pacers had to give up real meaningful assets for someone like Zubac, and the price tag is going to be pretty high for anybody that you feel actually good about up front that can help you on both ends.
And I think with the Lakers, I mean, they have a pick in the 20s this year. There are some bigs that, you know, I could see them taking, but I don't think any of those bigs you can rely on to be the guy as a rookie. They're not necessarily in the Lively Gafford mold. Maybe Malachi Marino from Kentucky, if he decides to stay in the draft, is a name that I'd think about in the mid-20s for the Lakers as a lob threat, but he's not as explosive as Gafford or Lively. And when you look at free agents, it's Robert Williams from the Blazers, but Time Lord hasn't stayed healthy throughout his career either. Like, he's shooting corner. They're trying to make him a corner three shooter now, probably in part because I don't want him jumping and landing as much on his knees that have suffered so many injuries. So there's no great option for the Lakers in free agency. And to your point, Andrew, the price is really high in the trade market as well. And I think LA, everybody, and we'll talk about it, LeBron with what happens there, but it's not just LeBron that's a free agent. Rui's an unrestricted free agent. Luke Kennard, Maxi Kleba, Jackson Hayes, all unrestricted. Reeves, Ayton, Smart all have player options, and it's very easy to see all three of those guys, or at least definitely Reeves and possibly Smart as well, opting out. And so if all those guys become free agents, and if they only keep the Austin Reeves cap hold, they'll have close to $50 million in cap space. Now, does that mean that you're able to use it on something that helps you out? I don't know. I don't know. But what's very clear to me, though, is LeBron's probably going to have to take a discount. I just can't see how they gave him the full max contract and be able to fulfill what this roster needs to be.
Kevin, is it time to bring Anthony Davis home after the last year and a half? Because he's available. Let me tell you, live from Washington, D.C., Anthony Davis is available. If Rob Pelinka wants to put the call in to Winger and Dawkins here. Yeah, LeBron, I think you have to negotiate the price tag down, if only because when you look ahead, like, this, the window with Luka is not going to be open forever. We've already seen his body start to break down a little bit, and we've already seen LeBron, Luka, and Austin Reeves is not a championship core. So you need to take some of that money and start bringing in pieces that you actually feel good about. It's going to be interesting with LeBron because there's such a sort of tortured history between him and the ownership. Obviously, there's new ownership now, but it seemed like things were in a pretty bad place last summer. And if they go to LeBron and say, yeah, we would like you to take a discount if you want to come back to LA, I really have no idea how he would respond. By the same token, I don't see that many destinations around the league that would make sense for him other than going back to Cleveland, who has their own salary constraints and would probably be asking him to take a discount in that scenario as well. So if he wants to keep playing, taking a discount in LA might be the most sensible outcome for him.
I think so, too. I think for LeBron, that's the best path in all likelihood. But at the same time, I could see him playing it slow and saying, what am I going to take a discount for? Show me what you're going to do. Is there actually something on the table that makes it worth me taking a discount? Or should I seek out a sign and trade possibly somewhere else? Right. Like, I think for him, I'd want to see them prove it before I take a discount, because if it's, let's just say the Cavs lose in seven to the Pistons, or they lose next round to the Knicks in a great 6-7 game series, LeBron might rather take even a greater discount to go there. Like, there's an argument to be made there. And who's to say the Knicks don't get losing five next round? And he's like, I'll be the final piece of the puzzle with the Knicks on a mid-level exception. You know, like, I think there's other options on the table for him to at least think about. And of course, the Warriors reunion with Team USA guys and Steph and all that. I'd play it patient if I were LeBron. I'd challenge the Lakers to do something. Because like you said, they haven't added much since they got Luka. So prove it.
Yeah. And we'll see. I mean, Rob Pelinka is going to have to be good at his job over the next several months here. Part of me does wish LeBron would just retire now and go out after a valiant upset in round one and going down, dying on his sword to a great Thunder team in round two, and then just go live happily ever after producing movies and, you know, bring the shop back to HBO. Because, like, LeBron going to the Warriors, for instance, or LeBron going to the Knicks, as somebody who's lived through the last 5 years of the NBA, like, that just sounds so annoying to me. It doesn't sound like something that would lead to a championship, but we'd all have to go through the motions and endure months and months of hype around the whole thing. And this Lakers tenure, all things considered, has been very successful for LeBron. I mean, they've won a title. They've made the playoffs most years. They've been a spectacle the entire time he's been there. So if it were to just end tomorrow and he goes out quietly, I would be so proud of LeBron for not dragging out the retirement and making this a year-long spectacle. Unfortunately, I just know that's not the direction it's going to go. And the only question is whether it's going to be an annoying Knicks story, an annoying Warriors story, maybe a Cavs story. I think that's the least annoying option on the board. Or come back with the Lakers, say you're retiring before the year, and drag it out for 9 months as we fet LeBron all over the NBA.
Oh, boy. I mean, it'll be very interesting to see what he decides to do with a retirement tour, or he's just going to announce it out of nowhere. That we'll see with him. Mm-hmm. But like, so the Lakers, you mentioned how they're in the playoffs basically almost every year. That's true. Since they won the title in 2020, though, they haven't had much playoff success. They lost in round one to the Suns in 2021, missed the playoffs in 22, got swept in the West Finals against the Nuggets in 23, lost to the Nuggets in round one and five games, 4-1 in 24. And then in 2025, they lost in round one to Minnesota, 4-1. Mm. And then in the West semis this year, they got swept by OKC. So for the Lakers, it hasn't been the most successful playoff run since the title in 2020. So if LeBron's time in LA is over, how will you remember his Lakers era?
Well, that's a helpful graphic because we should be clear to everybody watching on YouTube or listening at home that it's not like this has been some tremendous success for LeBron. Like, they've been underperforming, I guess, relative to some expectations. Like, every year the Lakers have, I would say, outsized expectations. The issue is, though, he's old. Like, he's been in the Jordan on the Wizards phase for several years now, and they haven't. I mean, Jordan on the Wizards missed the playoffs. LeBron has remained relevant through most of that time. And so if I were giving it a grade, I would say B+. And I would be willing to change that grade to an A+ if he takes my advice and goes with the Irish goodbye retirement plan here. But I don't think he'll do that. What grade would you give him?
I think a B. I don't think it's necessarily his fault that it's a B and not a A. The Lakers have made some disastrous decisions. My mind goes straight to letting Caruso go. He's their opponent in the series against the Thunder. And like, just some of the choices they made over time, I think it's been a lot of mistakes by that Pelinka front office.
This goes back to, honestly, I should actually lower my grade here to a B or maybe a B-, because a lot of the worst decisions the Lakers made, Caruso aside, like pushing for the Westbrook deal was a clutch play, not a Lakers front office play, and really kind of nuked what was a very good team that had guys similar to OKC who could play both sides of the ball, fit perfectly around LeBron and AD. And they went some weird directions. Some of that was on the Lakers front office. Some of that was on LeBron himself and the power that he wielded in that front office. And I think that's sort of a source of the disagreement and friction between LeBron and the Lakers ownership, the outgoing Lakers ownership with Jeannie Buss. So, yeah, I mean, his fingerprints are on some of the failures in addition to the sustained relevance over the last 6 or 7 years.
The other series of the Western Conference is entering a game 5 later tonight on Tuesday. Wembanyama got ejected, just a boom, an elbow right into Naz Reid's neck.
Vicious act from your guy, the league's golden boy. The ugliness out there. How do you defend what we saw in game 4, Kevin O'Connor?
Dirty play on the screen. I'm with Mitch Johnson. He's going to defend himself.
Oh, God. Of course I'm kidding.
I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. I was like the view of Dylan Harper. like, oh, my God. Did you see that? I couldn't believe he actually did it.
Yes, Dylan Harper. We were all Dylan Harper in that moment. Because of Wemby, he's such a cerebral guy that just came completely out of left field. I've never seen him do anything like that before. And credit to the Wolves, they were bothering him with physicality. I mean, you've got Spurs Twitter in overdrive to every single foul that the Wolves have committed in this series. They're slowing down and putting into hypercuts, acting like the Wolves are basically the bad boy Pistons, and this is the Wemby rules in 2026. I actually don't think it's been that aggressive in terms of what they're doing with Wemby. They're just being physical, and they're using his weakness against him, pushing him off of his spots. And in that moment, it's funny, when he elbowed Nas, I was watching, and I was like, I don't want them to throw him out over this, because as a rule, I don't want playoff games decided by ejections. But then NBC showed a couple more replays, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, I don't know how you don't throw him out based on what just happened there, because you can see Wemby. He knew what he was doing.
He looks right at him.
There was intent. It was very conscious. So, and then Wemby, after the fact, was very matter-of-fact about the whole thing. So, an entertaining spectacle that felt very playoffs. Like, you look at the rest of the second round, there's not a lot of, like, high playoff drama elsewhere in the second round. Wolves Spurs, though, is very much what I know and love about the playoffs. So I enjoyed it as a little curveball in game four.
I loved it. I mean, I loved it. I hope the Wolves come out super aggressive, pushing Wemby around in game five. I hope it's that type of game. I think these teams could thrive on it. I think the Spurs, they played pretty well without Wemby in that game four as well. They kept it really competitive. And so I'm just glad he's not suspended. He got the suspension already. It was three quarters. He missed the game. And now we enter a game five. It's 2-2. De'Aaron Fox is questionable for tonight. We don't have word yet as of recording about noon Eastern right now if he's going to play or not with a lower body injury. But entering game five, so far the Spurs are a plus 14.2 with Wemby on the floor, a plus 1.6 with Wemby off the floor. So that's just to put into perspective what we're seeing with him on the floor, as we've talked about throughout the series on both ends of the floor. If the Wolves win game five, Andrew, what's the story tomorrow morning? How did it happen?
Well, you asked me this. You said you were going to ask this question before we started recording, and I kind of froze because mentally, like, I've penciled it. Jaden McDaniels is in foul trouble now as we are recording this on Tuesday afternoon. I don't know how, like, friendly a whistle Wemby is going to get in game five, but I think if the Wolves breathe on Wemby, he's going to the line. So that's problem number one for Minnesota. Problem number two for Minnesota is the Spurs just look like the better team right now. Like, even in game four, there were stretches where any Wolves bucket felt like a miracle. And then Anthony Edwards takes over at the beginning of the fourth quarter, plays like a superstar, plays like an MVP candidate, and they get it done and get over the hump, dig themselves out of a hole that they created in the third quarter, and they get enough down the stretch. But even down the stretch, it's like, wait, suddenly they can't advance the ball across half court against these guys. And so you really feel the lack of a point guard. You really feel the lack of DiVincenzo as a release valve who can help sort of short circuit some of the doubles they're throwing at Ant and just get shots up really quickly. To answer your question, though, if they win game five, the story is probably Naz Reid goes off for like five or six threes. Mike Conley hits some threes, and they get enough help from the outside to shock San Antonio and really shock everybody who I think expects San Antonio to get it done in five, and then maybe Minnesota can steal game six on Friday. We'll see. But with Wemby out there, the defense is so consistently impossible, at least inside, that I just don't know if the Wolves have enough on the perimeter to get it done. But I hope that they will at least be able to push San Antonio, because this whole series has been so much fun.
I think the story tomorrow will be, if the Wolves win, it's going to be they had an amazing shooting night. I really think it's that simple, because you're seeing the way the series is trending with Wemby on the floor. Game one, 12 blocks. And the Wolves just kept forcing it. They took about a third of their shots in the paint or in the restricted area with Wemby on the floor. That dropped to 13% in game two, 13% in game three, and below 10% in the limited time Wemby was on the floor in game four, whereas their three-point rate has risen to nearly 50%. They're basically taking half their shots from three when Wemby is on the floor. So
that
it's going to be
the eye test.
Yes, exactly. Like, they're turning into, that's what Wemby does. He turns you into something that you don't want to be. That's what he does defensively. And so it's going to have to be everything you said: Naz Reid, Mike Conley, Ant going off from the perimeter, Julius Randle, McDaniels hitting their pull-up mid-range jumpers. It's going to have to be Ayo Dosunmu having an Ayo Dosunmu game like he did last round against Denver. He's 7-for-28. Since he got back from his injury, he hasn't yet had a great game. So I think it's those swing factors. And I think Minnesota's choices show they know that. That's why they're leaning into the three increasingly every single game, because that's going to be their only chance to win the series. Because it's like, offensively, the Spurs are getting what they want when Wemby's out there as well. I mean, it's an issue with Gobert against Wemby one-on-one. Mm-hmm. It's an issue when it's Naz Reid and Julius Randle are not big enough. There's no answer for the Wolves when Wemby is on the floor. And that's why it's going to have to just be a hot shooting night. I really think it's that simple, as, you know, surface level as that is. I really think that's it.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that's shocking is, you know, Julius Randle was very, very helpful for them in game one. And comparing the Randle that we saw in game one to the Randle that we've seen since, it's like two different players. He just looks kind of mentally broken by the Spurs defense, which is something that happened against the OKC defense. And there's a lot of similarities between the OKC defense and what San Antonio is bringing to the table. But if Randle is half as effective, or maybe even less than that, as he typically is, the Wolves are just not the same team. And Jaden McDaniels has been cold from the outside as well. So again, here, they're like, the deck is stacked against Minnesota. However, the Wolves, they're unkillable in certain contexts, and like, they were picked to lose their first round series each of the last 3 years, and they find a way to muck games up, and Anthony Edwards is a superstar. So I'm not going to count them out, and I appreciate them for making it this far and making this series so much fun. And I hope that they come out and rough Wemby up again and push him off his spots, make him uncomfortable. And I'm sure the entire team will be in foul trouble by the time we get to the middle of the second quarter. But it'll be fun. I can't wait.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really good one. I just think it's going to be a fun game. Hopefully down the stretch, very close. Can't wait for Tuesday night, Wolves versus Spurs. And I know OKC's rooting for a seven-game series, that's for sure. Get a month of rest for Jalen Williams.
Everything's coming up OKC. Yes. I hate it.
It is. Later on in the show, I got Dr. Brian Suterer talking about Darren Peterson and his creatine use.
To learn
a little bit about that. And you and I, of course, Andrew, will be talking about your Wizards with the number one pick a little bit later. But first,
I have some questions for Dr. Yes. Suter. Let me tell you, yes.
And we'll be right back after this break. Let's first talk about the Eastern Conference playoffs. The Cavaliers tied it up. They've won two in a row. All the home teams have won 2-2. Cavs have turned the series around. That 24-0 run in the third quarter against the Pistons. My God, James Harden. He saves game three. And then game four, ISO James Harden. Big game James is back. Andrew Sharp. I can't believe it. He's found it. 22 points using isolations in game three, 17 in game four. Harden looked old and slow the first two games of the series. Mitchell looked hurt. He looks like himself now. What changed in Cleveland? The Cavs look back.
Oh, my God. The playoff Harden apologies better be as loud as the disrespect was, Kevin, after 15 years of playoff failures.
Come on.
Here's the thing, man. We're both in the takes business at the end of the day. And I find myself looking at this series, wondering, is this series just untakeable? Because after four games, I don't know if there's anything that can be said about either team that I would feel confident saying in public. Like, Evan Mobley came back, looked good in game four, looked awful to start the series, you know, and Donovan Mitchell, superstar stuff in the second half, spectacular in the second half. I think he had 38, 39, 40 points in the second half, as good as you're going to get from any superstar in the NBA playoffs. He was bad in the first half. He's been spotty for 3 weeks for Cleveland. Like, do I trust Donovan Mitchell after the last couple games? Probably not. Do I trust James Harden after the last couple games? Definitely not. And the Pistons, like, I just don't know what to make of how, I mean, that run in the third quarter, is that the Cavs being great or the Pistons being painfully mediocre at times? I just don't know what to make of either of these teams. And it kind of feels like a 4-5 matchup in the first round more than a second round series. So I just sort of shrug my shoulders at all of this. Do you have anything more confident to say about these two teams?
I mean, on the topic of opinions about the series, like, I feel like both Pistons fans and Cavs fans hate me right now because I've been critical of the Pistons. It's a very rare thing.
And the teams have deserved it.
I know. Like, well, that's the thing. It's like look, Pistons fans, you went to a game 7 with the Magic. Get off your high horse about this team. You went to a game 7 against Orlando. Relax. And you would have lost if Franz Wagner didn't get hurt and they didn't have a historically bad shooting performance in game 6. So let's relax here. It would have been an 8-1 upset. And then with the Cavaliers, undeniably, it's been up and down with these guys. Sometimes Mobley looks amazing. Sometimes Mobley looks horrible. I'd love for some consistency from these teams to really feel confident in them. I did get a post. Somebody added me this morning and they said, Kevin, I appreciate that you call out the Cavs when the guys are playing well, and then you compliment them when they're playing great. I was like, exactly. I call it like
I
see it.
That's all I can do.
I call it like I see it. And I'll tell you what, in game 4, Cade Cunningham was horrible. He was terrible. Yeah. Both game 3 and 4. He might have had a triple-double in game 3. He was terrible. And then in game 4, casual Cade was back. Some of the shots he was taking that started that 24-0 run, he was took a pull-up 3 contested, never passed the ball in a possession. The turnovers he had, just too
the
casual.
Turnovers, man.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Why is he so casual with some of the passes he makes on the floor? These are unforced turnovers where it's not like he's being harassed, double-teamed. It's single coverage, and he's throwing the ball into traffic. And you go from casual Cade to clinical Cade, where he's just picking apart the defense and making good decisions and pulling up for mid-range, playing smart basketball. I don't know what to expect on any given night or any given quarter from Cade Cunningham, and that's part of my frustration and lack of belief with this Pistons team.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I was with the Pistons a couple weeks ago, writing them off after giving them the benefit of the doubt, because on the Greatest of All Talk, we were getting all these emails from Pistons fans being like, look at the numbers. The team is for real. All of America is counting us out. And they won me over and kind of wore me down, because I want what the Pistons did in the regular season to matter more than it actually does at the end of the day. So we get halfway through the Pistons series and I'm like, well, all the red flags that we were raising about the Pistons have been confirmed, and this team is just not built for the playoffs. And Cade was not playing well through the first half of that series. Then he comes back and looks like a super duper star, just controlling everything, giving Detroit exactly what they need. And so I thought we had turned the corner. Unfortunately, there's been sort of a relapse over the last couple games here. And particularly game 3, like some of the turnovers he had when that game was still in doubt. And he did. He came back and hit a 3 and I believe scored at the rim after the turnovers. But like just some of the decision making from him, I don't know whether it's a chronic issue, a function of fatigue or what, but it's just kind of baffling from a player who otherwise has all the makings of like a top 5, top 6 guy that we're going to be talking about for the next 10 years. There are still these weird moments where you're just like, what are you thinking? This is a big moment and you are really, really careless with the basketball. And the only other guy I've ever seen do that is Steph Curry, and Steph is Steph. So I'm allowing him to do that and not Cade, because the Pistons, the margin for error for them is much smaller than the Warriors, the peak Warriors had.
And even with the Warriors, is it a part of function of their system with the motion and movement and everything?
True.
And whereas the Pistons, it's stagnant. Like these are turnovers that should not be happening at all. And I think for the Pistons, one of my concerns with them, Tobias Harris fell back to earth in this game 4. He had 16 points on 17 shots after 7 straight games of 20-point games. I asked this on a podcast during the Lakers-Rockets series. I said, you know, Lakers are up 2-0. can you really rely on Luke Kennard to average 30 and Marcus Smart to have another 25-point game? The answer was no, you couldn't rely on that. I've had the same question about Tobias Harris. Can Tobias Harris keep averaging 20? Can he keep being this secondary creator that the Pistons don't have, but he's been able to provide? I don't think so. I don't feel much confidence there with Harris. And then you look at, well, then let's say he's back to being Tobias Harris. Jalen Duren? What the hell happened to Jalen Duren? His powers are gone. You can't rely on him either.
Duren, it's bizarre because he's somebody who I had truly suspended disbelief with over the course of the regular season, because some of what we saw from Duren was better than anything I ever would have expected from him, like coming out of the draft and even after some good or like encouraging first 2 years from Jalen Duren, it was like, all right, well, he's sort of a DeAndre Jordan type and he's going to be useful, but he's not going to be a star. But there were games he had in Detroit this year where he was acting as sort of a fulcrum for the offense and showing a little bit more skill. And he was very, very productive, certainly on the glass, but also as a scorer. And in this series and in the first round, he's been a shell of himself. And like the numbers from Duren in game four, where I think he had 2 or 3 rebounds, you just don't really feel him out there. And I don't know how that's happening. I know that the Cavs are happy to just pack the paint and make things really, really hard for Detroit offensively. And I'm sure that affects some of the scoring from Duren. But by the same token, it just seems like he's kind of wilting physically in some of these games. And I never would have guessed that would happen with Jalen Duren. And they're going to have to pay him a ton of money this offseason. I would not feel good about that if I'm Detroit, having seen what playoff Duren looks like. But I don't know. Maybe he'll turn it around in game 5.
I think it's a combination of things. Obviously, I do think there's a mental aspect that you're hitting on there. I think Cade's streaky shooting in the Orlando Spirit series, especially, they allowed them to pack the paint. We'll play Cade one-on-one. But part of it also in that game 4, some of the clips we showed on screen, they're not defending Ausar Thompson. They're just letting him.
I was going to ask about Ausar Thompson. Right? Yeah.
And so I think that is playing a factor with Duren as well, where you have basically a help defender in the paint at all times. And I think it's partially just good scouting too. Harden was the help defender on one of those plays where Duren got stripped. And it's like, he just casually like reached up with his left hand and swatted the ball away. It's like there's a understanding of his tendencies, where he's bringing the ball, what move he's going to put on what he's going to use. Because if you look at his regular season numbers versus playoff numbers in the half court, when he took a shot without dribbling in the half court during the season, he shot 69%. That's down to 61% in the playoffs. I don't think that's a big concerning drop off when he's not dribbling. That's lobs, it's cuts. He's not getting as many of them, but it's not an unexpected drop off. The big drop off is when he dribbles. He shot 59% in the half court when he dribbled the ball. That's down to 34% in the playoffs. Basically, see, cut in half. Like, that's a huge drop off, and he's getting more
and that,
of those shots.
By the way, that is what, during the regular season, they would run these high screen and rolls and then pitch it to Duren, and he would actually make pretty good decisions going downhill, like hitting guys, making back cuts for the Pistons, and they would get offense. Despite the lack of shooters, they would get either good offense from Jalen on those plays, or he would be able to find guys. And it was like, maybe he's more useful than I ever thought. He's definitely reverted to what I guess expected him to be a couple years ago, where he just looks pretty clueless with the ball in his hands in these moments. And the Pistons, they don't have enough good players to win if he's going to be that clueless. And you mentioned Ausar Thompson. There's been some Ron Holland as well. Like, a lot of guys who just aren't useful perimeter shooters have been a real problem for Detroit here. And certainly Tobias Harris is part of that story too.
Middle of last season, I had Bryce Simon, who runs the Great Pistons podcast, Motor City Hoops, on my podcast. And I said to him, I'm out on Jalen Duren. This was like in January of last season. I'm out.
Okay.
And then I was back in. And then this year I voted for him as most improved player. And now I'm like, I would not pay this guy. It's just amazing how quickly things can flip. And I don't feel a lot of confidence that either of these teams are going to be able to get through the Knicks, who are just rolling. They've won 7 games in a row now. Ever since they put the ball into Karl Anthony Towns' hands at a higher frequency, their offense just looks like it has so many layers to it. I think the Knicks are likely going to be going to the finals, possibly in just a 5 or 6 game East Finals, especially if the Cavs and Pistons keep beating themselves up and OG Anunoby gets more time to heal up. And with New York, Andrew, who do you think is the better matchup? Who are the Knicks rooting for to win this Pistons-Cavaliers series?
Well, it's funny because we just crapped all over the Pistons for like 7 minutes, and the Pistons could very easily go out and beat a, I would say, semi-fraudulent Cavs team in game 5, and the entire story could flip. And with the Knicks, the Pistons beat the crap out of the Knicks throughout the regular season. So I don't know. I think if you're the Knicks, you prefer to play the Cavs and just take your chances against this Cavs team. They've had success against similar Cavs nucleus, certainly the Cavs front line a couple years ago in the playoffs. And the Knicks are playing so well right now. I think you just bet on that offense continuing to materialize in the Eastern Conference Finals and being a better offense than what Cleveland can bring to the table. Whereas Detroit, they are going to beat you up in any series and could muck things up enough to make New York's life difficult, and certainly did that during the regular season. But by the same token, I'm shell-shocked about trusting the Pistons based on anything that happened in the regular season because of what we've seen over the last 3.5 weeks here. So it's a narrow choice to pick the Cavs. But I do think the Knicks are going to be favored against either of these teams. And they should be favored because the Knicks have unlocked something pretty real right now. And they look like an actual championship contender, which is not where I was with this team for most of the regular season. But to your point, getting Kat the ball, putting him in the high post a little bit and running things through him, like, they are awesome right now and firing on all cylinders. So between those two teams, who would you take if you're the Knicks?
I want home court, so I'd lean Cavaliers, but only for that reason. I think if it were home court for the Knicks in either scenario, I'd want the Pistons. I think that's the way I would put it. But ultimately, I think the Knicks would win either of those series. I don't trust either the Pistons or the Cavaliers to take down the Knicks, but I think the Cavs have a higher ceiling. I would say that it's just no home court for New York, so I'd lean there. And they smoke the Sixers, just absolutely destroy them, sweep them in 4 games. The Sixers already won their championship. They had a 3-1 comeback against the Celtics, and I'm very glad they got that moment. They got the Sam Hinkie post, right? Like, it was great. It's awesome they got that. But they did lose in the second round. They didn't get through the second round again, and they didn't get through the second round in part because the roster had 6 guys on it. And Maxey's having to play 47 minutes, and he's exhausted, and they have nobody, you know, Embiid, you can't trust him. He even misses a game. And then Tony Jones over at The Athletic wrote a story where he talked about the futures of Nick Nurse, Daryl Morey, how Embiid was unhappy with the team ducking the tax again. And Tony Jones wrote, "The jobs of Morey and head coach Nick Nurse are expected to be evaluated entering the offseason. As of Sunday's elimination, team sources said ownership has not made final decisions on either and is likely to take a few days to assess before making any major calls." We're at Tuesday now. We haven't gotten word yet.
Okay.
Nothing's dropped as of now. I think they would be making a mistake if they fire Morey. I think with Daryl Morey, most of the errors that have happened in Philadelphia have been as a result of ownership's pushes to duck the luxury tax. You look at the decisions that have happened. He hit on VJ Edgecombe. He hit on Tyrese Maxey in the 20s. He hit on McCain, Julian Champagne, Paul Reed, Isaiah Joe. Like, these guys are not on Philly anymore. They're playing for other playoff teams. All of them, McCain, Champagne, Reed, Joe, all of them are still active right now. But some of those guys were cut to get under the tax. And that's not Maury's decision. And so I think considering the circumstances, he's done a pretty good job building this team out, and you feel pretty good about their future. And I'd also feel confident that he's going to make a good draft pick with the choice they got in return for McCain at 22 mm-hmm. this year. There's going to be some good players available there. I wouldn't move on from him. I'd have a bit more split on Nick Nurse. But even Nurse, I thought he coached the hell out of that series against Boston last round. It was amazing. Agreed. He outcoached Missoula. So are you really going to make that change? I think the errors in Philly come due to the guy you can't fire, and that's Harris.
Well, it's Harris. It's also Joel Embiid. And yes. The only justification I could see for firing Daryl Morey based on what we've seen in Philadelphia over the last several years is if Morey came to ownership and said, we have to give Joel Embiid the max extension. And then you're a Sixers owner looking down at the paper that you signed, and it's, we're paying him 3 years, $187 million. You said that we had to do this. Why did we do this? Maybe that's the sort of thing that could produce like a whiplash that sends Morey on his way. But to your point, I think the failures in Philadelphia have basically been related to the ownership belt tightening. Like the McCain deal looks awful only a couple months later. But also, it's just the guys that they're relying on and the guy that they're relying on in Joel Embiid. As far as the margins and the work on the margins, like Morey found Kelly Oubre a couple years ago, who's been a really useful piece for them. He deserves a ton of credit for the maxi pick. Like, they basically lucked into a franchise cornerstone guard in the 20s. That doesn't happen. And like, sure, some of it is luck, but at a certain point you have to credit the GM as well. And so I think all that stuff tends to get washed away in the conversations about Morey, where people just look at the money that they've committed to their big names, the Paul George deal, which even in retrospect, I don't hate it as a big swing and the only path that the Sixers had to potentially putting together a title nucleus. Like, Morey's great sin is just going for it and taking big swings over the last several years. And it hasn't worked, but if I'm a Sixers fan, I want somebody who's going to be willing to take those swings, number one. And then number two, is going to be pretty adept at making moves around the edges of a rotation, around the edges of a starting lineup, and adding a couple useful guys from the bargain bin that actually move the needle a little bit. And Morey has consistently done that. So I think he's been really good at his job, but it's a very difficult job given some of the guys that they're building around in Philadelphia. I definitely would not fire him.
I think that is spot on, Andrew. And I like your point. It's tough for the owner. It's tough for the GM. It's tough for the coach, in part because the star player is making $50+ million and plays under 40 games. Just hard. It's hard to win that way. And you hope Embiid can have one healthy year and that the Sixers have the right roster around him. It just doesn't look like you can really bank on that happening. And that's a real shame because I love Joel Embiid when he's on. I love that guy. And hopefully he can get healthy. But I look forward to seeing what the Sixers do. We'll obviously talk more about Philly once we have more clarity about the Nick Nurse, Daryl Morey situation, either later in the week or next week or whenever we find out. But one thing we do have clarity about, Andrew Sharp, the Washington Wizards have the number one pick in the NBA draft. Oh, my God. How excited were you? What was your initial reaction when that card got pulled up saying Utah number two?
My initial reaction was shock. Like, there have been videos around D.C. where people are screaming and bars are going crazy. I was sitting in my car watching on my phone, my one-year-old daughter in the backseat of my car, getting kind of antsy. We're at the airport waiting to pick my wife up. And so I literally pulled over by the side of the road watching on my phone. And I just sit there. I had never imagined for a second that the Wizards were actually going to get the number one pick. So it was just waves of shock for about 5 minutes where I'm like, oh my God, they really did it. Then I started getting text messages. Like, that entire time I was getting all these text messages, somebody mentions Utah got number two. And I realized that I was so locked in to the Wizards at the lottery, I didn't even pay attention to any of the other teams in the top four. And I saw Utah sitting there at number two after 5 or 10 minutes. And I was like, well, that is interesting, because Utah has been obsessed with AJ DePanza since he was like 15 years old. So maybe there's a deal to be done. I don't know. But it's not like pure euphoria. It's not like winning the lottery in the Wemby year or the Cooper Flagg year. There was joy, there was shock, and then there was a little bit of anxiety, because there's some decisions to make in DC, and we got to get this right over the next 6 or 7 weeks here. So Winger and Will Dawkins, they're going to have to be good at their job as they land the plane with the number one pick.
If they stay at number one, who do you want them to take?
If they stay at number one, probably AJ DePanza. He's the safest. He's got a pretty high floor and clearly a very high ceiling. I think the appeal of a trade, I don't generally like trading down in the NBA, because the outcomes, the higher you go on the board, are just much better statistically, in the draft. And so oftentimes teams can get a little too cute trying to plan for the future and have their cake and eat it too. The issue, though, and the exception to that rule, is if you just think a player is better than the consensus number one, and you can move down a spot or two and get the player you think is better, then it makes a lot of sense to try to extract as much value as you can. And I personally, in my gut, think that Caleb Wilson is going to be the best player from this draft when we get like 6, 7, 8 years down the line. Wow. He's not as polished as DeBanza. He's not as polished as Darren Peterson, but I just love his tools. Best athlete in the draft, best defender projected among the top five here, and great intangible. So it's, I expect him, because he's a winner, to figure out how to be a star. And I acknowledge that it's going to be something of a project for the first year or two. But I think he plays so hard, he will make a winning impact from day one and then just get better and better and better as the years pass. So I would go with him at number one if I were making the pick. As a Wizards fan, I have to accept that I don't have the power to actually make the pick. And I'm not going to be mad if they go to DeBanza. Not going to be mad. I'll be very anxious if they go Darren Peterson, but we'll see. You're not a Caleb guy, though, right?
No, I like Caleb a lot. I really like Caleb.
Okay.
I think he's incredibly talented. I think there's an outside shot he ends up the best in the class. It's going to depend a lot on his jumper. I mean, he's got the athleticism. Mm-hmm. He's got the lob catching ability. He can handle a bit. He can defend at a high level. He plays hard. I don't think there's any question about him working hard on the court or off the court. It's just a matter of, is he going to be the guy that we saw in the first half against Duke, against Kansas, in those games where he was hitting turnaround jumpers, pull-ups,
yeah,
spot up threes, and you're like, oh my goodness, this guy looks like he could be the best player in the world in those moments. And I think that's where, if he can do that, if that becomes a thing by the fourth or fifth year of his career at a consistent level, yes, he could end up the best player in the class. I think his ceiling is as high or higher than anybody, but his floor is probably not quite as high as DeBanza, or as Boozer. I think he's a lower floor than those guys. I think Peterson is the widest range in all likelihood as with upside and downside, considering injuries and all that. And I'm a little surprised that Jonathan Gaboni, he was on Zach Lowe on Tuesday. He was like hammering for Peterson at number one. I had Chad Ford on my show, and Chad Ford's like, I would go DeBanza. And I bet you these are the exact same debates happening within the Wizards front office. You're popping out of nowhere saying, well, I think Caleb Wilson could end up
throw Caleb into the mix.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, and then you got Boozer guys too. If that's what it is within the Wizards front office right now, I guarantee it.
Yes, I love that meme, and we are back up, maybe up for the first time in about 35 years or 40 years, I don't know, not since 78, 79 have we won 50 games in a season, but it's going to happen at some point over the next couple of years. The Caleb note, the one thing I would add is he is going to have the best highlights of any prospect in the draft. The highlights themselves are a little bit misleading. I watched a lot of full Caleb games, and to your point earlier, there would be a half where it'd be like, oh my God, he's put it all together. He's an unbelievable, unstoppable star. And then there's other stuff where it's like, he's still figuring it out, and the offense can get pretty clunky. The jumper isn't quite there yet, and there are some questions. That's why I would say it's a speculative gamble at number one if they go that direction. But that's like, if the Wizards meet with everybody and watch these guys work out and come away thinking internally, Caleb Wilson is going to be the best player 10 years from now, or Darren Peterson is going to be the best player 10 years from now, or Cam Boozer is going to be the best player, like, then plan to roll with that guy and maneuver accordingly. See what you can extract from Memphis. See what you can extract from Utah. Try to get some good young players and a pick. I just love that the Wizards are even in this situation right now, because like things don't work out for us, Kevin. And so I love that they're going to have the leverage in any trade discussions that they have. I will say the Gavoni clip, because that was immediately shared all over Wizards Twitter. I can't get there with Darren Peterson based on what I saw at Kansas. I mean, basically buying on Peterson requires blacking out like the final 3 months of his season at Kansas, where it's not about the character stuff. Does he love basketball? Blah, blah, blah. I'm not going that direction, but like, he was not a creator at Kansas at all. And they had him playing off ball alongside Melvin Council, but like, it just didn't look like he had that skill set really. And then he stopped going to the basket entirely at Kansas, and he wasn't hitting shots down the stretch for them. And his body just did not look anything like the athlete that he was in high school and that shows up on the highlights. And in an 18, 19-year-old kid, it's concerning that he went to Kansas and it felt like he aged 10 or 15 years over the course of a five-month freshman season in Lawrence. So all of that just kind of spooks me as far as making an investment at number one. But apparently the Wizards like him, so that could be the direction he goes. And I'll be fully prepared to talk myself into any creatine explanations if that's where the Wizards end up in late June. I don't know. Are you buying on Darren Peterson? What do you think? How do you make sense of this?
I want to find out a lot more about what happened at Kansas. I don't think that ESPN Ramona Shelburne's story changes anything. Every NBA person I've talked to says it doesn't change a thing. And my coming up conversation with Dr. Brian Suterer, which we recorded prior to our conversation, Andrew, I have even more questions after that conversation with Brian. So, Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today. Congratulations, number one
thank
pick,
you.
Washington Wizards. Where can people check all your work, Andrew?
Well, I'm on Stratechery recording podcasts every single week. So if you subscribe to Stratechery, you can get access to Sharp China, which is a U.S.-China geopolitics podcast, Sharp Tech, which is a technology podcast, and then Greatest of All Talk. I'm wearing many hats, Kevin. Greatest of All Talk twice a week with Ben Golliver, covering the NBA all year round from top to bottom. And it's a lot of fun. Every podcast at this point is now like 90 minutes or 2 hours because there's so much to cover this time of year, but we're loving every minute of it. So we'll keep it rolling, and people can subscribe to that at greatestofalltalk.com.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Always great to see you.
All right. Thank you to Andrew. Now, talking about Darren Peterson with Dr. Brian Suterer, who runs the best sports medicine channel on YouTube. He's a great, great watch. If you don't know him, check out Dr. Brian's channel. And hey, this is a very informative conversation. I learned a lot here, and I think you will too. Darren Peterson says high doses of creatine caused the condition that led to his cramping this season. But is there more to the story to discuss? It's Dr. Brian Suterer. Hi, Brian. How's it going?
I'm doing great, Kevin. I was just saying, we've talked offline so many times. It's really nice to finally be talking to you here virtually in person. Hopefully talk a little about this story, because it's a a very interesting story that I think, right, that the time is relevant with the NBA draft upon us. And so I'm glad we had a chance to talk about this story and hopefully learn a little bit.
Well, I mean, they dropped it at the perfect moment right before the NBA draft combine after Peterson missed 11 games this season, played under 25 minutes in 7 of the games, pulled himself a bunch of times. He says it's creatine that he began taking when he arrived at campus at Kansas that caused these issues that he had throughout the season. What was your initial reaction when you first saw this report?
My initial reaction to this was there has to be more to the story. It's too simple of an explanation that honestly the science doesn't really make that much sense. I think we have to start just understanding like what creatine is, right? You probably remember back in high school, college, like creatine is probably the most common like basic bread and butter supplement that people will start to take when they're into kind of fitness, exercise, et cetera. And so point number one with it was really hard to believe that him coming to Kansas was the first time that he had had any exposure or, you know, fitness coach that was telling him about taking what's probably the most consumed and used and studied and safe and efficacious performance supplement that we have. So right from the start, there were, I would say, not necessarily red flags, but some yellow flags, we'll call it, that kind of went up about the timeline and what exactly they were claiming had happened.
I think that was my first thought as well. It's like creatine. I know about creatine. I'm not even an athlete. Yeah. So this is my first time taking it. Kind of a bit of a surprise there. And then it's the type of thing where, well, you know, he has a full body cramp. He said there's the legs, the stomach, the back, the arms, the hands, and then the full body. And the cramping was so severe, he said they couldn't find a vein. They needed multiple IV bags, hours in the ER, sore for days. And he said, quote, "I thought I was going to die on the training table that day." I'm sure cramping can be a result of creatine. However, this would seem to me like something a bit more extreme. Was he ingesting the whole tub of creatine, not just a 5 gram dose? Right. Like what could cause something so extreme here, Brian?
Well, the first thing too, when I heard about how severe the symptoms were, right? I'm a sports medicine doctor. I take care of Division I college athletes on a daily basis. And we're all very familiar with the idea of an athlete who has whole body cramps. And the key there is whole body cramps, because we've all seen athletes pull up, right? A calf cramp, a hamstring cramp, some sort of, you know, focal muscle cramp in a limb whenever they're competing or playing. But the idea of having like full body cramps puts it in a whole nother level of severity, because there are life-threatening conditions that will cause whole body cramps. And so this is, you know, kind of bread and butter of our athletic trainers and our docs. And those are conditions like rhabdomyolysis, something that you might have heard about in athletes that can be fatal, where such extreme exertion, hardcore exercise, typically worse in the summer in the heat outside, causes such severe muscle breakdown that you get whole body cramps. That muscle breakdown, which we'll get into, because the marker of it is something called creatine kinase. And so there might be some confusion with where he's describing creatine, but you get this buildup of this enzyme, creatine kinase, in your bloodstream. It can plug up and kill your kidneys. And that is fatal potentially if not treated, and requires hospitalization, high doses of IV fluids. And absolutely, I've seen athletes with this, they feel like they're going to die. And so there are much more real life-threatening situations that absolutely can cause whole body cramps. And when I first heard the story, I thought, well, it sounds more like rhabdomyolysis, sickle cell crisis, and individuals who have sickle cell trait, where the hemoglobin protein in their blood that carries oxygen is abnormal in a way that causes their blood cells to sickle. African-American individuals are more likely to be carriers of this. Sickle cell crises, when that happens, can cause whole body cramping. And so for that medical staff that's going through that in the moment, creatine supplementation is like dead last on the list of what you're going to be evaluating for after these life-threatening, real scary conditions.
Now, you mentioned rhabdo back in like January, February, when I was toying around with Claude and Gemini and plugging in everything I knew. Like people do, you know, before they go to the doctor and they're plugging in all their symptoms. Rhabdo was mentioned as like, well, maybe he suffered rhabdo. Maybe this is what happened. Do you think that
certainly
is likely? I mean, it seems like this could be what had happened, right? Could it have been something else?
The hard part that you have to be careful of there is, and part of it right. I mean, we're all reading between the lines here, yes. right? The timeline of the reporting, et cetera. What you have to be wary of is anytime an athlete goes into rhabdomyolysis, it makes the training staff reflect on like what they did, because typically there were signs, there could have been things that the training staff did that they shouldn't have done. And so it can very, very quickly cross a line. It's almost like negligence on the part of the medical staff and the training staff. Now, there are athletes that are certainly predisposed to it. You can take certain medications. If you have athletes that are pounding energy drinks and they're taking stimulants, that puts you at higher risk of it. And so it's not like it's a situation that's entirely on the medical staff, but I can absolutely understand why this happening to a medical staff, they would not want it to be public. They would not want to be advertising and putting it out there that they had a high profile athlete that suffered rhabdomyolysis, because it can be a poor reflection on the school. And so while yes, it certainly on surface sounds like this could have been rhabdo, like 100%, I don't think we should go as far as to start, you know, laying the groundwork that might put some blame on the medical staff when there truly could have been other factors out of their control. But absolutely, it's something that I guarantee is on the mind of every NBA medical staff who heard the story.
Now, when I talk to NBA people, they say, okay, so the story here is that he started taking creatine at Kansas. It caused this major episode and some of the episodes throughout the year. He stopped taking it, and now he's good. That's the story. But they say, but why was there at least one known cramping episode at Prolific Prep a year ago then, which required him to yeah. eat a whole mustard packet on the bench? It was the game against AJ DiBonto where he scored 61 points, an amazing performance. I believe there may have been a few other cramping incidences as well from the people I talked to around the league, minor ones, nothing major. But okay, so let's say that's true. Clearly it wasn't the creatine then. There could be something underlying here. And I guess my, you know, uneducated, you know, thought here is the full body cramp seems like the event, but what was actually the cause if it's not creatine? Sure.
Yeah, that's a great way to think of it. And when we think about what causes cramps, it helps to understand like the two main reasons why cramps occur. The typical bread and butter cramps that you see on the football field are going to be more neuromuscular fatigue related cramps. That idea of how your brain, your spinal cord is causing the muscle to fire, that process that's trying to run efficiently in the background can become fatigue, so to speak. And all this stuff about, you know, slamming salt packets, mustard packets, it's a little bit of a misunderstanding, because you're not actually changing the electrolytes of your cells and blood in a quick enough timeline for the cramp to resolve. That just kind of became the like old school way to deal with it. Ironically, there's some thought that it's actually the bitterness of that mustard, like on your receptors and like the throat, that suppress the spinal cord reflex that's causing the cramping, but whole other physiology discussion. But essentially, it can be that fatigue component, or you can have a true underlying physiologic problem with the way that your muscles are working, right? Your muscles are this very finely tuned process of calcium, sodium ions, crossing cell membranes, proteins firing, enzymes like creatine kinase, the role of creatine in how your muscles fire. This is a finely tuned process that has a lot of opportunities for things to go wrong. And part of the manifestations of those conditions that can be true, like metabolic disorders, can be that you are more predisposed to cramping. Now, I think it would be very hard for an individual with one of those underlying conditions to get to the level he did and be as successful as he is, because usually these are pretty debilitating conditions. But absolutely, I don't think it's safe to or fair to put blame on creatine, that just simply taking high doses of creatine will cause full body cramps. Now, that might be the gasoline on the fire, so to speak, of something that's underlying in the background with hydration, with other supplements, with an underlying medical issue. But I don't think people should be afraid of creatine in isolation causing whole body cramps.
Now, let's just say creatine was a factor here and that, you know, there's some truth to that. Wouldn't he be at risk for his entire career with any supplement that's introduced if something as safe as creatine, proven over decades, is causing issues like this?
Yeah, you could. And I think the unique part of creatine, and this is where, you know, as somebody who covers like sports injuries and tries to educate the media, I always get really hung up on nomenclature, because I think Peterson even had a quote where he talked about the levels of creatine in my blood were high. But like, there's no blood
just
test.
That
like,
manly.
You don't go.
He's just that tough.
Yeah, like you don't go to the doctor and get a blood test that measures creatine. Like that doesn't. That's not a thing. But what you can measure on a blood test is something called creatinine, which is a byproduct of the biochemical reactions in your body, commonly used as a marker of kidney function. So you can measure your creatinine, or you can measure the creatine kinase. That's the enzyme that goes really high when you have rhabdo. And so, right, like there's so many layers of telephone here where like maybe they were measuring his creatine kinase and he just said, well, they measured my creatine. Because certainly like muscular individuals, African-American individuals, people who are very active will generally have higher baseline levels of creatine kinase. But creatine kinase is not creatine. Like creatine kinase is the enzyme that allows creatine to do its thing, but they're not one-to-one. And so that whole fact of like, they measured my creatine level and my creatine level was high, like isn't a thing. And so that part of it right away makes you wonder, well, were they measuring creatine kinase? The creatine kinase was high. Therefore, you were closer to being tipped over the edge if you went through a hard workout, had some dehydration, had supplements on board. That just compounded the problem.
Now, let's say you worked on a medical staff for the Wizards or the Jazz or the Grizzlies or the Bulls, one of the top four teams. What would be the things you'd be investigating here with Peterson, either medical tests or questions for him, digging for intel? What would you want to find out to know if you can feel confident drafting Peterson to your team?
I think honestly, having the medical records of when he supposedly went to the hospital that time would answer almost all of this, because they would have checked the creatine kinase levels. They would have checked all of these blood levels at that time and made a diagnosis. And I would be very surprised if, you know, when they went to the emergency department to get those IV fluids, right? Because I believe he said he was at the hospital, correct?
Yes. The ER
so,
he went to.
Yeah, the ER, right? So there would have been a diagnosis given of like, what are we treating here? And I don't think they would have put in, you know, creatine overdose, and they would have had blood tests, and those blood tests would have explained what the underlying physiologic damage was, and that would help the medical staff understand what actually happened. I think whether or not they're able to get those records, I don't know, but that would be the main thing if I'm on the medical staff is, okay, what actually happened at the emergency room that day, what labs were run, what subsequent testing was done, because you theoretically would have your athlete, if one of my athletes had something like this happen, I mean, we would be having them see specialists to undergo additional genetic testing. And so you would want the results of those tests. I don't think this is a situation where you can simply talk to the athlete and rely on what the athlete says. And that's not a knock against the athlete. That's more a testament to how complex these situations can be. And so having the direct medical records of what evaluation was done, what testing was done, what was the diagnosis given, would answer that question for you to understand, hey, is this going to be an ongoing issue or not?
The one part of the story that stuck out to me, and you know, first time I read it, I was like, huh, that kind of makes sense here. Ramona Shelburne wrote, the full body cramp was so intense, Peterson said that he struggled to shake the fear that it could happen again. And then Peterson himself was quoted in the story and said, whenever I felt anything like that come on, my initial thought was that it might get to that again, and I can't let that happen and be embarrassed and have that on TV and all that. It kind of put me in a tizzy because I didn't know what was causing it. Nothing has ever been wrong with me before. Basketball is my life, what I love to do, but something was going on and I couldn't figure it out. And I've talked to a ton of different people across the NBA, across college basketball about this, and you have people in one camp saying, you know, it's something physical. And then you have people in another camp saying it's something mental, that there's a history with him, even going back to high school in certain situations. And with this in Kansas, that he's the type that like anytime he feels something, he's pulling himself out. He's basically saying that with that quote. He's saying, whenever I felt anything like that come on, my initial thought was that I can't let it get to that again. But that's a lot of incidences over the course of the year when play under 25 minutes seven times and miss 11 games. That's a lot of times over a college basketball season.
Yeah, I think it's got to be both. I mean, I think it can absolutely be both mental and physical. I mean, any athlete, dealing with one of the biggest things in ACL recovery nowadays is the mental readiness of an athlete getting back to sport, almost being just as important as their physical readiness.
Tatum with the Achilles. And that was a big part of it.
Exactly. Huge part of it. And so I think we're getting better as a sports medicine field of recognizing that mental side of things. And I'm glad, because absolutely true. And again, that's not a knock on Peterson. I'm glad he's expressing that honesty, because I think that's an important thing then for staffs that work with him to be aware of and give him that support, because absolutely something that sounds like might have truly been like a potentially life-threatening instance. I've had health issues myself where you feel kind of something come on and you're like, oh no, here we go again. And the brain starts to spiral and then you can't perform at that level. You've got to perform. So I think it's fair that it could be both, but I will say time heals all in a sense. And I think hopefully that diagnosis is correct, right? I think at some point we have to sort of take it for their word of what we're being told is going on in these situations. And if that's the case, then okay, avoid creatine and you're going to be just fine. If that's not the case, then making sure the individual understands all the information about what happened so that they're not confused about why it may happen again is all you can do. You try to educate them, you give them the mental health support along the way, and just be there with the continuous counseling, understanding, and encouragement to help them get through that. And eventually with time, the less it's going to happen, things tend to be better.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Brian, getting the medical report from the time he was in the hospital. Would that medical report lead you down certain directions if it is something underlying, like neuromuscular issues, something like that? Or would further testing be required from an NBA team?
Yeah, it depends on the circumstances. So if you have an athlete who presents to the emergency department and their picture fits with, for example, something like rhabdo, there's going to be a clear kind of sequence of events that led up to it where you can say, okay, this clearly happened because of what transpired in the hours or days before. It's when you don't have a clear explanation that you have to go down that pathway of doing more workup, right? So something happens and there was no workout associated with it and somebody has whole body cramps. That's what would send you down the pathway. And you would have to give Kansas the benefit of the doubt to assume that they had done that. I mean, this is an elite college institution that's got resources for any medical specialist around the country. And so if there was a clear explanation for why it happened in the moment, you're not going to need to go down further workup and do all this crazy testing. If there's no explanation for it, then the proper thing to do, which I'm sure they would have at the time, is to go down and have all that testing. And this was presumably months ago, right? So that was another kind of odd piece of the story, right? Is that you don't really look back necessarily 2 months later and say, well, it must have been the creatine like that day back, you know, 2 months ago. And so either they did a bunch of testing, found nothing and said, well, okay, maybe we chalk it up to the creatine, or right, the things that we're all kind of speculating and postulating on might have come up because of the timing, et cetera, of what it was going on. I mean, I hope that for his sake, he has the true answer of like whatever it was. I hope that nobody in his camp is trying to, you know, like sugarcoat the problem or sugarcoat the issue. And like when athletes have rhabdo, if they do, I mean, it's not like a career threatening thing. I mean, it's something that you generally recover from just fine. You learn from it and you move on. It's not like you're necessarily at risk of it happening again, as long as you understood the things that caused it and control for the things that caused it.
On that note, Brian, like what is something like that would cause it? I mean, if it's exertion, you're playing 82 games, you have back-to-backs, 3 games in 4 nights, travels, lack of sleep in certain situations, all these factors, double overtime, playing, you know, 45 minutes some nights. Are those things that could cause those types of episodes?
Conditioning's a big part of it too. So usually when we see this in athletes, it's the summer, it's when football camp first starts. It's when it's really hot outside. It's typically not a situation like at the very end of the season when the conditioning is to a level that it needs to be at. When this typically happens, I mean, the unfortunate common story you'll see is somebody who was pushed too hard in a workout, somebody who was starting to develop symptoms, was starting to develop some cramps, was, you know, complaining about not feeling well, not, you know, feeling nauseous. And a coach or somebody who pushed them and just said, you know, suck it up and toughen it out. And then the process spirals. And so when you get to these higher levels, there's more awareness of it. Conditioning staffs are more familiar, comfortable with like proper principles of loading and ramping up activity. And so the higher you get, you tend to see this less and less than like a youth, a high school, you know, a junior college level.
Well, Brian, I'm hoping Peterson can get back to what he was in high school, because the dude in high school, at 6'6", with fluidity and athleticism, I mean, he just, it's really such a cliche, but he moves like water. That's what he was at the high school level, just the flow and the explosiveness and the burst, the ability to get to a second, third, and fourth gear, changing pace. He's like, he's genuinely a beautiful basketball player when he's fully healthy.
And I'll say, I think he can. You know, to that point, like, I don't think I've seen anything with the reporting that's like, oh my goodness, this is going to be a disaster of a career. I mean, when teams want their player to succeed, they have the resources to help make their players succeed. And certainly there's always going to be a mental component with any athlete, right, that you can't predict. But from just a pure medical perspective, I don't think you get to the level he did with some underlying scary thing that teams should be worried about. I think when you get to this level, you only get more and more resources to help you get there. And so, yeah, I agree 100%. And I don't think there'd be a reason to doubt that he couldn't. It's just important you understand the truth of why it happened so that you can hopefully prevent it from happening again.
Brian, thank you so much for joining me, man. Keep up the amazing, amazing, amazing work with your channel. You do the best stuff out there. Keep it up, man.
I appreciate that. And I got to quickly just to publicly put this out there. For those that probably don't know, Kevin was one of the first people that gave my YouTube any real credibility. So I got to give you a shout out for that. I still remember because I loved following your stuff back over with The Ringer. And I remember sending a message and seeing that you had seen, I think it was my Victor Oladipo Pacers video when he was with the Pacers.
That was a long time ago.
And it was a long time ago, yeah. And you responded to it. And I thought, holy cow, like legitimate like NBA reporters and like podcasters and all this are seeing my stuff. And I think you sent a little message of like, hey, keep up the great work. So you probably don't remember that. I remember that. I was very thankful for it. And so I was very happy to finally be able to come on and help contribute a little bit to your side of things here.
Thank you so much, Brian. That means a lot. Keep it up, man. We both will. Yeah, both of us care. Will. I know both of us aren't going to stop hustling.
That's right. Yeah. Thanks, Kevin.
Big thank you to Dr. Brian Suterer. I'm not sure whether to feel better or worse about Peterson after that conversation, but there's a lot more to learn about him, I'm sure, this week at the NBA Draft Combine and in the weeks to come that's going to get revealed. Thank you to Brian. Thank you to Andrew Sharp as well for joining me earlier to talk about the NBA playoffs. I'll be back on Thursday, me and Tom Haverstraw, live at 11:30 a.m. Eastern. We'll be live that day talking about everything going on around the NBA and the NBA draft. And I hope you have a good week, everybody. Thank you to Emmy for producing us. Have a good one.